Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from ISF and Films and Stuff podcast. Today we have a very, very special guest. In fact, we have a couple. But first, I would like to say hello, as always, to my wonderful co-host, Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Say hello, Rachel. And how the fuck are you, Carl?
I'm doing just fine. So first off, I'd like to introduce a very good and old friend of the podcast. He's been with us for a number of years, or with me when I was with Stephen Ronquillo, and he is the editor of Wings Chop. If you have never read Wings Chop, it is one of the greatest cult film magazines books you have ever seen in your life. And Tony, it is a pleasure and a wonder to have you back, my friend.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
And Tony was instrumental in basically getting me our special guest today. As I must admit, I had never heard of you beforehand, Amy. I had never read Tony's reviews that he did for Wings Chop. So forgive me for that, but I am now.
Hello?
Amy, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So I think the first question or the first thing is when I saw your films, of course, you have a very, very unique journey as how you got involved and where you got involved in film. So why don't you give us a little background about how that happened?
Oh, so I made my first film in Bolivia. I've made the majority of the bulk of my work in Bolivia. And I went there as a tourist in 2000, I believe 15 or no, what is it? No, 2005. Gosh, okay, time. And I stayed and I found, you know, because I found a bunch of people who wanted to make films. And so that's exactly what we did. My first film, Sirwinyaku, was very polemic there, but it ran in theaters for 5 months straight, and so that was very encouraging. And I just went on to make more films, but now I'm back in the United States and continuing that journey here.
Okay, so one of the things that I noticed very, very much, I guess one could, you know, they've tried to pigeonhole you as a horror director, and I do see elements of that certainly in your films, but I feel that there's a lot more to your films than that, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, what subjects in that interest you that you bring into your films and that sort of thing, so we can give the audience an idea of what they're going to experience when they watch your films.
I'm particularly fascinated with relationship dynamics and family dynamics, in particular dysfunctional family dynamics, the role that family, how family can like pigeonhole us into a role in life. I deal a lot with sadomasochistic relationships. That's about. I pretty much
beat
those
right?
to death.
Go ahead,
Rach.
If you don't mind me cutting in here real quick, Carl. I actually. Genuinely, like you and I have already talked about how we both believe she focuses a lot on, you know, relationship dynamics and stuff. And to me, by the way, Rachel here fangirling over the fact that there is another female director out there that's doing some really respectable work, because that is not something you get a lot of. especially in the, I guess, you know, somewhat pigeonholed horror category, as it were. But I do feel like most of the horror in the movies comes from those relationship dynamics. Like, I've had some really fucked up family relationships, and those are the things that scare me more than the torture and the pain is, holy shit, I have to deal with these people in my life. So for me, that's like the real aspect.
Yeah.
That's the real scary part.
It is. I should clarify that I don't consider myself to be a female director. I'm actually non-binary, to throw you a curveball there.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, but let's have a round of applause for my uterus, but whatever. And
actually, I find that amazing, even more so. My 12-year-old came out as non-binary a little while back, so that is fantastic. They're going to love
That's
to hear
so
about
cool.
this
yeah,
later.
My spawn is also non-binary, so it's just like, you know, it's all in the family.
That is fantastic. Okay, so, Carl, like, we've got some more people for June, because, yes, this is awesome. Okay, well, either way, having someone out there doing the work that you're doing and exploring these dynamics in such a different way is just wonderful, as far as I'm concerned.
It's
based up in places.
Amy, do you mind if I ask real quick, just so nobody screws up, what is your pronoun preference?
Oh, I like Zizir, but if that's difficult, they, them is fine. It's just like people aren't really used to that one. I'm trying to, like, advocate for it, but, you know.
I'm a big fan of they-theer as well.
Can you repeat
that
pronoun again, Amy, please?
Zizir, like Z-I and then Z-I-R.
Okay.
Zizir. Okay, so Zir. Okay.
Yeah.
Z.
Yeah, Z
or Zir.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense.
Will do.
Okay, got it.
Cool.
Carl's taking notes.
Yeah, the thing is that horror really is, to me, it's a genre that is very, I feel free to talk about a lot of, you know, or let's say horror fantasy. There's a lot more leeway to talk about these issues in a way that it's very organic, because people aren't necessarily expecting it to be real life. It can be
exactly.
A heightened life. And so, you know, when I touch upon these things in drama, like I did with Shiranyaku, that was inflammatory for a lot of people. It was very polemic. A lot of people didn't handle it very well. And so I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that I moved into the horror genre is because, somehow these issues are far more acceptable. Like, they're easier to swallow because people aren't saying, oh, but that's not my life. I don't feel exactly that way, or, you know, things like that.
Okay. Now, one of the things I wanted I'm going to give it over to Tony. And Tony actually has interviewed you a couple times for Orange Chop. So, Tony, do you want to say anything about Amy's work?
I've been a big fan. I first met Amy in, I believe, 2013, was it, Amy, at the Polygram Film Festival?
So.
When Z was there with the film Barbazul, or Bluebeard. And I had met Zier at a previous screening, and Barbazul was to film or was to screen a couple days later. I couldn't get off work, but I showed up just as Amy was finishing up the Q&A part. So I ran up and said, look, I'm sorry I missed your film. Where can I see it? And boom, he just handed me this screening copy and said, here, take it home, watch it. So I was delighted. So I got to go home. I watched the film and fell in love with it immediately, and then went back and purchased the filmography and particularly fell in love with Shiranyaku, which I consider to this day one of the more romantic love stories out there in independent cinema personally. So I've just been a fan ever since, and I have kind of kept in touch with Amy on and off, did the interview for Wang's Chop in issue number 8, and just do, I'm always looking forward to a new Amy Hesketh film personally, so I got delighted when Rucker came out, which I hope, has everybody here seen Rucker yet?
I have seen Rucker. I don't believe that Rachel has yet.
Okay.
I have not yet. We kind of had to divvy up the movies because it's been a really busy few weeks for all of us. But I do not mind spoilers because they do not affect movies for me. So you go right ahead with what you need to say.
Okay, well, I won't go into detail yet. We'll let Amy do that. But personally, I thought Rucker was both a very interesting departure from the rest of Zier filmography. However, you could still totally tell it's an Amy Hesketh film. And that's one of the things I love about it, is it is kind of, it feels both separate and subversively inclusive. And subversive is probably the biggest word I would use to describe Amy's body of work, no matter what genre. I really only see Olaya and Rucker as actual horror films. The rest are, to me, more multi-genre. Amy might disagree with me on that, but that's just how I view it.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could definitely describe my work as subversive. I like to subvert all expectations all the time.
and you do very well on it. You do very well on it. Trust me.
I really, you know, I believe like one of the biggest differences in, you know, between Rucker and my other work is really just that, you know, the location where I'm making it. I'm heavily influenced by locations. And, you know, having made a lot of my other films in Bolivia and some period pieces and things like that, they're heavily influenced by that kind of just the Baroque. You know, it's like I'm surrounded by this, you know, Baroque architecture and, you know, this a different way of being. It's a Catholic country and so on. And being up here in the Pacific Northwest, it's different. It's more spare. And, you know, the influences are therefore quite different with Rucker. It was also, you know, I think I was working through some family issues with that. And I do that with all of my films. I really dig into deeply personal issues. And so I was dealing with some issues with my family and my father with that film.
One of the things I want to talk about very briefly is that two of your films are based on literature. And I just wanted to know, one of them is Olalo, which is Robert Louis Stevenson's short story. And the other one, of course, is Bluebeard. And I wanted to basically ask you, you know, how well did you know the literature? Was it something that really spoke to you for a while, or was it something that you discovered and then worked with? How did that all work out?
So with Bluebeard, that's just been a favorite story of mine since I was a kid. And I really liked, especially the Angela Carter retelling of it. And I thought that it was interesting, and yet it, you know, explored it from a feminist standpoint, which was quite interesting. And I wanted to do something even farther, even more fucked up and weird and different than that. And while it is definitely, it's funny with that film, I was accused of being a misogynist and with that film. And I think that, you know, when that happens, I'm assuming that the person who's accusing me of that didn't quite realize that the perspective is not Bluebeard's in that film. The perspective is told entirely from the perspective of not quite final wife or girlfriend of Bluebeard, because she's reading his journals. And so it's all her skewed perspective of what he's doing. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a different retelling. With Alalia, I was going through, I was staying with at my dad's house, and I was taking care of him because at the time he had a terrible dementia, and which he shortly, like about a year after he died. And I was trying to, like, help him and get him into, you know, a healthcare situation, which would be stable for him. And it was terrifying. You know, it's like you're locked in a house in the middle of nowhere in Maine with somebody who's absolutely not in their right mind, and you've tried your best to hide everything that could be used as a weapon. And, you know, it's like I'm upstairs and I'm like digging through some, you know, like big boxes of books and all kinds of crap trying to deal with that. And I find Robert Louis Stevenson's Alalia, and I'm like, oh, this looks interesting, you know? And so I just, you know, bring it downstairs and I, you know, give it a read. And I said, oh, wow. Okay. This is everything that I'm experiencing right now, this weird dynamic, you know, and feeling like I'm being put into this position of, you know, that I've inherited some kind of, you know, dysfunction from my family, which is really what Alalia is about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting to me that you're using historical literature and bringing a whole new perspective on it. And, of course, in doing so, you know, it's not only the point of view which you pointed out, but it's bringing a different perspective. For me, like Alalia was really, really affected me a lot in many terms. The one thing that really I think is unique about what you do is, you know, and I'm trying to wrap my head around it so I can say it, is that the horror elements of the film aren't the disturbing things. It's not the blood, it's everything else. And this is a movie that just like shook me, and there are very few films that do that, and so you are to be commended.
Thanks.
Seriously.
Thanks.
Well, and I personally have always had a really weird fucked up connection to Bluebeard, because my grandmother, who weirdly enough also passed from dementia, and we had to do all of that crazy shit for many years. It took us like 10 years to get her into care because of living wills and things like that. Bureaucracy, as it were. But one of the things that I remember about her, because she kind of lost it when I was pretty young, so I don't have a lot of interaction with her other than her being the scary grandma, was that when she was still verbal, and I stayed over at her house for a little bit one time, and she didn't want me to go into this one room, and she totally Bluebearded me. She told me that the key that was in the door was going to turn red if I touched it, and freaked me the hell out at like 3 years old. And I had never heard the story of Bluebeard, so a few years later, I was reading a book of fairy tales, weirdly enough, in that room that I wasn't supposed to go in, and I read Bluebeard, and I'm like, holy shit, like, this is what she did to me, but by that point, it was too late. And,
yeah.
So I've always had a really special connection to that story, and when I read the version that was in the book Grimm's Grimmest is when it, like, really sunk in. Like, it was just as fucked up as I always imagined. And so, and that's one that gets left out a lot. So thank you for bringing that one back. Just a little personal one for me there.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they're really, I think most gothic stories like that are very classic, you know, and they involve characters who we know, you know, all of the kind of stock characters that can be found in gothic literature are people who we still are these people. And so it can, you know, we know them.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. Go ahead, Tony.
Oh, no, I'm just listening and appreciating. I don't want to interrupt. I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Well,
I mean, I
right now.
Well, I do want to bring up one other thing.
Go ahead, guys.
Is because you mentioned the literary references of Olalia and Bluebeard, but there is a tangential literary film, which is The Marquis de la Croix, which was not directly an adaptation of the Marquis de Sade's work, but was definitely drawn heavily as an influence. So it you know, to me, that is another one of Amy's literary films, even if it's not directly based upon a specific work.
Definitely. I think that one is definitely influenced by literature in more of a meta way, but absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
And I would even argue that, you know, it might even be your most challenging film. I mean, if I had to pick a favorite, I would probably still pick Olalia, but Le Marquis de la Croix is the one that challenged me the most as a viewer, because it's so much about subsumed interpersonal dynamics, much more than it is plot. And so to me, it's a far more challenging film than just, you know, lining up a bunch of things that happen and change people's lives.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's where, you know, I get at the real horror, you know, the terrible things that people do to others. That is real horror. This happens every day. It's, you know, it happens to people when they're children. It's like all these things. And I think that, you know, it's when we create stories around them that are more heightened, it's easier to watch. You know, it's like, it's really tough. I mean, you know, you're picking something to watch and it's like, oh, you know, it's like, you know, children are being molested. Yeah, I don't know if I want to watch that. It's just like a drama story or something like that. And it's like, you know, I might pass tonight because I'm not feeling in a good place. And instead I'll pick some kind of like crazy horror film. And how is that any different? It's really just, you know, codified in a way where we can remove it, you know, from ourselves, hold it out there and watch it instead of participating in more of an empathic or empathetic way.
And that's,
very
true about horror. That's very, very true about horror. I've always said that it's a way for people to get out those feelings without having to connect. Now, talking about connection, my background is music. Okay, I'm a church organist and also ran a music store and sold print music, you know, for years. And that was my day job. And I have to really, really applaud the music in your films. I could just not even watch the movie and just listen to it. That's how much that the music adds to the experience. And your choices of music and styles of music, which you know, sometimes it like doesn't seem to fit, but it does. Olalia, for example, that wonderful clunky piano chords, and then again with the flamenco music and the music, some of the folk tunes of Bolivia. I mean, just all of that just really, really adds to the experience. And I must say that's even true of Rucker when they do the, karaoke. I just thought that was one of the most wonderful scenes I've seen.
Yeah, that was a great multi-layered scene.
Oh, absolutely. But the thing I want to talk about right now is the use of music and how did that come about in terms of your films, particularly your Bolivian films.
I listen to a tremendous amount of music. And funny enough, most of the music that makes it into my films, it's music that, you know, sure, I listen to, but not necessarily. It's more music that, to me, helps to tell the story. Absolutely. Because the music that I listen to every day, or, you know, when I'm working in my office, is just like, you know, guttural metal or something, you know, which isn't necessarily the best thing to put in my, you know, films all the time. You know, and so, you know, Schnittke, Paganini, you know, a lot of, I find that it's music that has its own story attached to it. And I'm, so, you know, it's like, I really consider myself not really a horror filmmaker, but a meta filmmaker. A lot of my
right.
films have multi layers, or, you know, it's going back and forth between times, or, you know, it's, there are, and so to me, music is really just another meta layer in a story to help tell that story. It's not just, you know, and it can help to put the audience into a place where they can feel the feelings that you want them to feel at the moment that they should. And so I think that, you know, music is extremely important. A lot of the time people, you know, don't give it enough consideration. You know, there are other things that I use a lot in my films, like that are probably imperceptible. Like sometimes I'll use things like LFE rumbles, low frequency mm-hmm. emissions, and things like that, which can help to make people feel a little just bad.
Uncomfortable.
You know?
No.
Yeah. And I feel
and,
like that's necessary sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of care involved, and that's what I wanted to. To bring out. There's also the sense that it's a counterpoint. I will tell you, watching your first film, I'm never going to hear the Mozart concerto, piano concerto, again like it was used. Seriously. Just amazing that you would pick that particular piece for that particular scene or set of scenes. And of course, with the Schnittke and that sort of thing, I'm a, you know, classical, you know, I grew up in a household where all I could listen to when I was young was classical. So to hear these things and that, and to see them fit so well within the context of your film and to impart more structure to it, I think is just wonderful. And I wanted to applaud you on that, seriously.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay, so let's talk about Rucker, because I think this is a really, really good film. Tell us a little bit about how Rucker came about, and what we'd like to do is talk a little bit about how it was budgeted and things like that. This is one of the things I work with the ISF people, and a lot of our members are trying to be first-time filmmakers. So just tell us how all that came about.
Oh, it came about originally in terms of the origin of the story. My spouse, Aaron, he had this idea for a while and, but didn't want to talk about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's like that. He'll have like, oh, I have this idea, but I'm not ready yet. But, you know, because he knows that like, if a
yeah.
pitch isn't ready, it could, you know, it's going to get shot down. I mean, here, you know, I'm going to poke holes in it and stuff. And so we'll wait for the right moment. And so it just so happened that we got snowed in. You know, so it was just around here, there's like one snow plow for like the entire county. And so it was going to be a while, like a week before we could get out. And so we called around and the only place open was this, pizza joint down at the bottom of the hill. And so we trudged over there through the snow and had some beers and pizza. And, you know, Aaron finally laid it on me. You know, and he was like, oh, hey, yeah, it's about this like serial killer trucker. And I was like, oh, cool. What if it were about, you know, this woman who's making a documentary about him? And what if we kind of like switched back and forth between views so we don't necessarily know, you know, through whose gaze we're seeing him? You know, that might be interesting. And he was like, oh, okay, great. And so, you know, over the course of the next few months, we read the script and we kind of traded it back and forth. And then I did the last kind of polish on it, so to speak, and we just started going into pre-production because it was ready and it was doable. And it's because we had that going, and there's another one that I hope is going to be our next film called Piñata Non Grata. But Piñata Non Grata is a little harder to make. It involves, you know, just hundreds of piñatas. And so I was just like, oh, no, we can just, like, make this right now. With a very low budget and the resources that we have, because I'm a film professor. I'm a tenured professor at Olympic College, and my husband Aaron is he's also a professor there of screenwriting and producing. And so, we were like, hey, what if we make this? And we, you know, we bring in key players, you know, we bring in some cool people, and you know, fly in a few people, but we make it, you know, largely with, you know, our students helping out. And so we did that. We also, you know, we made it in Bremerton, Washington, which is where we live. And it, we received a huge amount of support from the community here as well. And so that, you know, when you're putting together a film, an indie film, it's really, really important to have support. You need a lot of support because that support means soft money, right? You know, when you talk about hard money and soft money and where your money goes when you're budgeting a film, you know, that soft money is going to be a massive, massive amount. You know, it's like you can get hotels for free. You can get Airbnbs sometimes. You can get, you know, sponsorships from locations, you know, and all kinds of help like that, you know, and then like resourcing, you know, students, for example. It's like, well, they need internships. Okay, so let's fill out the paperwork. This is great. You know, like let's be their supervisor on the internship. And, you know, and then, you know, your hard money expenses are really just going to be about plane tickets and, you know, craft services and catering and, you know, things like that that you might not be able to get as much sponsorship for. And so, you know, this is what I teach. You know, we teach this, like how to put together these films, because we've done it over and over and over again, you know, with investors, without investors. And, you know, we do it as a labor of love. And, you know, so you just have to be smart about, you know, like what your budget is, and write the screenplay for a specific budget. You know, it's like, maybe it doesn't need to be in space, you know? and then you go from there. You make it real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So what you're saying is Rucker was originally supposed to take place in outer space, right?
Yeah, totally. And that's totes. And I was just like, nah, man, I think it's rough better.
It's a really good film. One of the things, and I don't want to give away too much, but you don't just use the camera. There's actually animation in this film. I found that to be a very bold choice, and I know exactly why you did it, because it's a different point of view. But just talk a little bit about the animation and how that came about and how you made that decision and how that was produced into the film.
When I was writing one of the drafts of the screenplay, you know, it's like, I think we need, let's, you know, and I actually think it might have been Aaron's suggestion to do animation because he's really, really, you know, loves animation. And he's making a meta animation film right now, which is very cool, called Long Night. I just drew a bunch of children's drawings, right? Because at first we thought like, oh, well, maybe we want really realistic animation, you know? And because I didn't, you know, the scenes that we're showing, it's like, sure, you could say, oh, okay, let's just get a kid who is supposed to be, you know, this kid. And I'm like trying to not say spoilers here, but, you would just film these things, you know, how it's not that hard. But in that respect, it's like, well, whose mind are we looking at? Who, you know, like, what kind of memories are these? And, like, whose memories are these? And, you know, I wanted there to be a question of, like, whose memories these are and whose perspective we're looking at them from. And I think that, you know, later on we kind of clarify that with, you know, the card, right, that Rucker has, mm-hmm. that his daughter, you know, drew for him, that says, "I love you, Daddy," and has this, you know, some drawings and pictures and things like that. And, you know, at that point, you know, I want the audience to still wonder, well, is that Rucker's, you know, imagination of what his daughter had to go through without him? You know, whose memories are these? Are they memories? You know, and what are they? And maybe they're a combination of his daughter and, you know, his memories. And so I think that with animation, you know, creating, you know, that other meta layer, so to speak, that's kind of like the third meta layer in there, in that film, it helps to, like, create a curiosity, let's say, for the audience, so that they have to kind of, like, hunt around a little bit and say, look, and question whose perspective we're looking from.
Yeah, right. One of the greatest most fun aspects of Rucker is, you know, for the first few minutes of the film, you think it is from one very specific point of view, and it unfolds like an onion. I'm not going to, once again, give any spoilers, but it unfolds to a very nice array of different points of view in order to tell its story. So, I mean, from the beginning, you think, okay, this is going to be a faux doc or a found footage film, so to speak. But mm-hmm. it's so much more complex than that, and it is very rewarding as each layer gets peeled away. And the concept of the unreliable narrator comes into play and things like that. So it was really refreshing to me to see a film that took liberties with the narrative and also, once again, challenge the viewer to embrace each narrative or a narrative point of view as its own thing, and then work out in their own minds what to make of all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a film that the viewer has to process it to a certain degree. And the other thing, too, is, again, there are horror elements in this. Of course, it's, you know, a serial killer. But to me, there's a lot of humorous and a lot of a very human points of view and experiences in this. Again, I'm trying not to give away some of the relationships and such. But it really is. You know, I mentioned the karaoke scene, and I can't think of the character's name, but the one who does the real crazy
Taco
karaoke
Tuesday?
At the end. Yes, Taco Tuesday. I love him. And
that's Corey
I must
Taylor
say that,
from Slipknot.
Okay, is that Corey Taylor? Whoa,
yeah.
I didn't realize that. but the thing about it is, the acting in the film, I think, is top notch. Seriously, you've got some really good people, and they sold the whole film for me. I mean, if you don't have those two major characters do as well as they did, I think it would have been less successful. And they really pulled their weight, and you should tell them that, because I really think they did extremely well.
Yeah, Bobby and Cheyenne were really very, very good to work with. And, you know, Bobby's a really seasoned actor and started off in theater. And so it's, you know, I didn't know him. Aaron knew him from his previous film, Fear Clinic. And, but when I spoke with him on the phone, I don't know, I just got this like really crazy sense that he would be very right for the role. And it was also like how keen he was on the role as well, after reading the script, that I knew that there was something else there. that would work for the film. And indeed, you know, when we peel back those layers, he definitely had a very personal connection to the film, and he talks about it in some of the behind the scenes, interviews that are on the Blu-ray. And you know, he had recently reconnected, with his daughter. And he had a lot of, just very, very, similar issues, not necessarily similar, but relatable issues with his father. And so, you know, it's almost like the character was really written for him. And so it was, I think that, you know, it was, not only is he an amazing actor, but I think that that helps for him. My wish for my actors a lot of the time is for them to take on a role that brings them catharsis as well, even though they might be going through a tremendous amount of pain to play it, they will feel like they've been transformed or even like transmogrified by that experience, and that we will witness that wonderful process on the screen. And Cheyenne is my former student, and I knew that she would be really, good for that role. But she's, because she holds a lot inside with her acting, and I particularly like that because it's very important to the story about exactly what Maggie is holding inside. Mm-hmm. And so, has been carrying around with her. It's very key to the story unfolding, and how Rucker relates to her as well. It was also really fun to work with Corey Taylor. He's a blast. Jessica Cameron. He is. He was really fun to work with. His wife, Alicia Dove Taylor, she's in it as well. She was fantastic. It was her first role. Jessica Cameron, Leona Britt, they were all really, everyone in the film was just absolutely fabulous.
Amy, do you mind if I ask, when Aaron came up with the initial concept, did he have Bobby King in mind, or was it just happy coincidence that Bobby King ended up being such a perfect casting choice?
He didn't have Bobby in mind when we wrote it. It was really just when we came to the casting stage that he was just like, I think I might have somebody, let me check, he messaged Bobby and asked like, hey, what are your avails? And we're going to send you a script. So.
Wow. That worked out wonderfully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So talk to us a little bit about after you filmed and that sort of thing, what type of post-production and then distribution, and where can people see this movie?
Absolutely. So the post-production was pretty laborious with this just because I wanted to get, kind of a cut together before we put in the animation. And so, we did that. My editor, Sherwood, is absolutely fantastic. He got a cut together. We took a look at it and then sent that to Dorian Clevenger, our animator, along with the script for, just those scenes. And then, it was really just letting Dorian do his thing. He gets it. And he got the film on a really deep level. He was like, oh, I get this, And so I was just like, okay. And we had, some great conversations about it. And then he sent back, some stuff. And I had basically just minor adjustments to make with that. The music was quite interesting just in terms of trying to get the rights for Seasons in the Sun and Obsession. Just because they're really, right. It's like I don't know how I just pick the most complicated fucking songs in terms of like rights. It's like terrible, but Mason Cooper did a really good job, and they're locked in. And then the other music was composed by by Tripp, and he really got it as well. And so it's like he took some really, you know, like wonderful time to kind of like really think about it and, you know, like labor over it a lot. And I think that really shows. And so that came together. It was really though, you know, when we moved into, you know, the bulk of the post-production, then the pandemic hit. And so instead of, you know, being able to fly out to New Jersey and do my sound mix with Angelo, it was, you know, we had to go back and forth and try to do Zoom and like all of these other things. And so it just really drew it out, kind of to the point where it was normally, I definitely labor over every film that I make, you know, but this one was like really, really laborious to get it through post-production. But then finally it was done and I was like, fuck yes, you know, it's like we finally did this. You know, and our colorist, like he locked in everything else and it was just, so it was great. And so we did that. And then, you know, we shopped around for distributors quite a bit. And we had some really amazing offers, from a bunch of different distributors, really, really great people. But we ultimately went with Giant Pictures. You know, so far they've been very good to us and they recently bought, Draft House. Film, which is interesting. I was just reading about that in Variety. The film is available right now on Vudu, Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, Xbox, Microsoft, Comcast InDemand, and Rogers Canadian Cable. I think that it still has a run, you know, for rental and purchase on there, and then it will go to streaming. And then after that, it will go to AVOD, like Tubi and so on. So, you know, if people, you know, are really itching to see the film, then, you know, there are plenty of places to watch it right now.
And I would recommend it highly. I got to watch it through Amazon, and it's well worth, I think it's like $3.99 to rent. It's well worth the price, people. Absolutely. So Amy, what are your next plans and what do you have in the pipeline?
Oh yeah. So, Piñata Non Grata is next up. And it's a really wacky film. That one deals with, you know, really fucked up relationships. So it's about a therapy group that meets in the back of this pinata shop. It's a therapy group for the brokenhearted. And Peter Bill, their leader, he helps them to, you know, make a pinata that is in the shape of their pain that they're feeling from their breakup or rejection. And then, you know, when they make breakthroughs, right, they talk about it, they make breakthroughs, they get to whack their pinata. So eventually the pinata, you know, gets whacked enough where they're able to access the goodies inside, right, which is a metaphor for, you know, an actual breakthrough of being able to access their internal goodies, right? And it's that part's really fun. But see, the therapy group members go rogue and they start thinking that maybe this therapy is like, this is really fucked up unless I like, you know, confess my soul, I get to whack this stupid pinata. Like maybe either I can fast track this shit right here, you know? And so they go and try to confront their exes instead. Which is a really bad, very, very bad idea. Some of these involve dressing up in giant cupcake outfits to try to sneak into a cupcake bakery and declare love. It just ends in a lot of violence and weirdness. So
that. I love this idea.
I do too. I'm thinking this would be a perfect midnight movie for those of us up on the balcony with certain herbal enhancements, perhaps. I don't know.
You know what? Movie. Like I'm a big fan of stoner comedies. I think that the best comedies are actually stoner comedies. Dude, Where's My Car? I mean, hello, this is it's like a miraculous piece of amazing genius.
Yes.
I think it's wonderful. Yeah.
It really is.
So, Amy, I have to admit that it's wonderful not only to meet you, but to find a whole plethora of films that I've never heard of that just totally has blown me away with what you've done. And you are certainly on my radar now. And I think it's wonderful. And I suggest to everyone listening to this, you know this person, know Amy and know her work. I'm sorry, I just screwed that up. Pronoun was, but know the work because it is well worth it. And we haven't heard from Rachel. Rachel, do you want to say anything else while you're before we start with housekeeping and all that?
Oh, I've just been sitting here fascinated. I mean, I want to watch all of these movies, obviously, because I'm very limited in what I've seen so far. But everything I've heard has just, like, gotten better and better. And seriously, I can't wait for the Pinata movie.
Well, it's just so Taco Tuesday's not in it.
Yeah, right.
Little in joke if you've seen Rucker.
Yeah, you know who? Yeah, I know. Actually, that's one of the reasons that I put that scene in Rucker.
Oh,
it's
awesome.
A nod to a future film. Yeah. But yeah. Oh, okay. So just weird aside here. I was at the dermatologist the other day, and my dermatologist Casey was just like, "Dude, you know who you should totally cast in Piñata Non Grata as the lead?" I'm like, "Who, man?" And he's like, "Kanye West."
Whoa.
And then the whole appointment, it was basically like, I'm like, what are we doing here? Because all we're talking about is how he might be a good casting choice. And then who his agent is. And then, like, who I need to contact to get to him because I can get to him. But it's just like, I was like, is this a really good idea? I don't know.
Yeah. Or is it the most dangerous idea ever?
Probably, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny,
I mean, he is,
funny
like,
things.
The craziest person on the planet, so.
And might have some good subtext for this.
And,
you know? I don't know.
Yeah, and also might have a cathartic experience by working through some issues.
Totally.
I would touch that with a 10-foot pole, Amy. I think I'd keep away from that idea.
Amy, did you want to also let people know where they can get your earlier films?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
My earlier films, a lot of them are available on Amazon. They are available to rent on Vimeo, and they're also available through VermeerWorks.com. So they have DVDs. They also have streaming and rentals, downloads, things like that as well.
Yeah, I was able to see a couple of them through Vimeo, and
mm-hmm.
it's well worth it. The interesting, I have one other question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're in Bolivia. You do these films. They're primarily in Spanish, but yet you know you have some English in there. But how did you find working down there in Bolivia as opposed to dealing up in Washington and that? Was the communication in terms of the crew and everything, did that all work out well, being bilingual and such?
Yeah, totally. I think that, you know, a lot of people in the industry in Bolivia know to some extent some English. And I'm trilingual. I speak Spanish, French, and English. So, you know, for me, it was actually more challenging to come up to the United States and direct a film because I had directed so many films in Spanish that all of the language for film directing was in Spanish in my head, really. And so I had to keep translating it into English, which was really weird. And so that was a thing. Making films, and the similarity here is just the amount of support. I have a huge amount of support for making films in Bolivia. In 2015, the government gave me an amazing award, after 10 years of working there, for my contributions to Bolivian cinema. I have a huge amount of support, in order to facilitate making films down there, and just the people, the amazing people who I work with down there. And so it's really, I kind of created that for myself up here in Washington by creating the film school, because mm-hmm. it's, I'm training other people to be my peers.
Right.
And to network with each other and to enjoy filmmaking as much as I do.
Well, I think what you're doing up there. Go ahead, Tony. Go ahead.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. Sorry. But I was just going to say, doing what you're doing up in Washington with the college and the courses and that's a wonderful thing too. To this is what we try to do here on a small level, is to just have fun and to let people know it's good to do these things and just go ahead and try. Don't be afraid of it. And I think everything that I've seen from you and heard from you today and meeting you, it's just a wonderful thing to have you with us. And also, you're always welcome back. So if you have a new project and that sort of thing, please let us know. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Carl.
Okay. Okay, so Tony, any other things you want to say to Amy before we start wrapping this up?
Not really. Just you keep making them and we'll keep watching them and do our best to let all of our nerdy friends know about them.
Absolutely. So at this point, we are going to do what we like to call housekeeping. And right now, I can tell you this, we've got two shows that are coming up. So our friend and author, Patrick Crane, out of Oklahoma City, is going to be with us on Tuesday for the podcast, and he just had a wonderful experience where he was the MC and introduced a whole new film to the people of Oklahoma City, and that would be Shakespeare Shitstorm, which is, of course, Lloyd Kaufman, head of Troma, and he just interviewed and did a Q&A with Lloyd Kaufman. So we're going to have him on Tuesday. We're going to take a look back at Troma, and we're going to hear all about what Patrick had to experience out there. So we're doing that.
Shakespeare Shitstorm is a crazy movie. Have you seen it yet?
Not yet, but listen, it's Troma. What do you expect from Troma?
It is Troma to the Troma's power. That movie is nuts. I saw it at a film festival last year, and it is Troma had sex with Troma and had more Troma.
That is a great endorsement right there.
But they should have that on
list now.
That movie's fucking nuts.
Okay, and also I just got confirmation on tax day, which is April 15th, I'm going to be recording the show with a very, very good friend and author, Joe Lansdale. Joe Lansdale, if you don't know who he is.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Yep, Joe Lansdale. Happy lettered. I ran across Joe a couple years ago when I was doing podcasts with Stephen Ronquillo. And that first podcast, there's a whole 5 or 10 minute thing of it, of us just talking about cooking. So he sends me, his recipes, and I'll send recipes back to him. I mean, we really hit it off. And he had a
nice.
Special thing a couple days ago with the New York bookstore online. And I got in contact with him, and he has a new book, which is a new compilation of Happ and Leonard stories that have never been published.
Yes.
And so he's going to be on with us on the 15th, and we'll get that up and going.
The last time we interviewed him. Do you remember this, Carl? I'm disappointed. You know, I love the Happ and Leonard stories, and of course I'm going to get this book, and of course I'm going to fucking love it, but I'm disappointed that he didn't publish the Happ and Leonard cookbook that we talked about, okay? I need that recipe for Nilla wafers.
Well, maybe he'll get around to it.
Yeah, see, I'm going to tell him that this time. Like, dude, you promised me a cookbook last time you were here. What is this shit?
Yeah, we love Joe Lansdale. We absolutely adore him. And he's a wonderful man and a good friend of the podcast.
And I do have to say that now, as of today, official decree, we also adore Amy Heska.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's what we have planned. We have other things coming up, but I don't have them, you know, set in stone yet. So, but we will finish up Women's Month, and we're certainly glad to have you with us, Amy. As I said, you're always welcome back, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Carl and Rachel and Tony, for being with me.
Absolutely.
You have a fucking fantastic night.
Absolutely. And I think at this point, we should just basically say good night and thank you very much for listening, folks. Say good night, people.
Good night.
Bye,
John.
Oh, come on. Say good night.
Good night, y'all.
All right. Good night, people. Have a good one. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.